Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
This is the James Gray Show podcast edition. Please do leave us a rating or a review wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, you can tune into the show every weekday from 1 p.m. until 3:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
Fine start for England. Bright sunshine in the West Country. It looks rather lovely. Why are we here? Why aren't I at the cricket? Honestly, I should just be. Although David Willey's got entirely too much sun cream on his face. It looks really sort of very, very, very white. You know when people, I never understand cricketers who do this, they wear sun cream, but it's that sort of zinky stuff that doesn't actually rub into your skin. It just sits on the surface of the skin. Maybe David Willey hasn't been spending enough time in the winter playing cricket in some sunny climes, and he hasn't quite got that base tan, so he's struggling a little bit. But yes, Pakistan 7-1, and we'll keep you up to date with that as much as we can. I do, though, want to talk about this Manchester City story, because I think perhaps people think this comes around every year and nothing happens and they just sort of move on. Oh, yeah, City at risk of financial fair play. No one's surprised because obviously, you know, their squad cost $1 billion and the Sheikh has invested about £2.5 billion now into the club, whether it be in players or facilities or the stadium, in fact. So I don't think people ever are surprised when financial fair play comes up in a headline with Man City. But this story is a little bit more significant, because Man City find themselves threatened with a ban from the Champions League. The basic facts have emerged this week, reported brilliantly, by the way, by Tariq Panja in the New York Times. Well worth reading the full story, but essentially it's as follows. A group of investigators, which is convened by UEFA, sort of combined people with knowledge of various different parts of football in Europe, they were put together to investigate a number of top clubs' accounts. And 2 weeks ago, they had a meeting and sort of talked about what their conclusions might be. That panel, by the way, is, as I mentioned in the top stories there, led by the former Prime Minister of Belgium, which I just quite like. It's just sort of one of those random little facts. Anyway, they could file a submission as early as this week to the UEFA disciplinary process with their recommendation. According to Tariq's article, the body are expected to seek at least one season ban from UEFA competitions. Now, remember that City have been sanctioned before. They were fined £50 million back in 2014. The reporter in question actually points out rather smartly and neatly, actually, to quote, even the suggestion of a ban would be a stinging rebuke for City's Gulf owners. Remember, the whole point of owning these football clubs, it's not to make money. You're not going to make money. It's very hard to do that out of a football club. It's geopolitical positioning. It's Sheikh Mansour trying to say, look, we're the UAE, we're a multinational organisation, we're good people. It's a sort of PR stunt, basically, an expensive one, but that's what it is. It would also delay their overall goal, and, you know, within that PR stunt, this ban would delay their overall goal of winning the Champions League. It's why the club was built the way it has been, and it's the thing that Pep holds above all others. You know, this whole club was set up for Pep Guardiola to win the Champions League. That is the very raison d'etre of the club. So if this ban comes in, it's just going to set them back another year. And we know that the Champions League is this big bugbear. You know, Guardiola said this year, oh, he didn't think the squad were ready to win it. Well, if they're not even playing in it, then they certainly won't be ready to win it. The fans, though, for reasons which I'm about to point out, don't necessarily love the Champions League. And this is kind of where it gets interesting, because Manchester City fans have this hate-hate relationship with UEFA. It's not even a love-hate one, it's just hate. It seems to stem back, or at least it started back in 2011. Mario Balotelli was subject to some racial abuse from Porto fans, and the club were fined just £16,000, having been found guilty of that racial abuse. Now, it almost feels like a cliche to say that UEFA don't fine clubs heavily enough when it comes to racial abuse, but it's true. And it was particularly bad when you compared it to a month later, Sporting Lisbon were fined because their players were 30 seconds late coming back out onto the pitch, and they were fined £25,000. So what's worse? According to that fine system, coming back out onto the pitch late is worse than not controlling your fans who are racially abusing other players. Not very good look. And then, as I mentioned, City were fined £50 million a couple of years later for overstepping FFP. The fans felt this was unfair because they looked around at other rich clubs. And this kind of whataboutery doesn't work. You can't just say, oh, well, what about this club? What about this club? No, if you've broken the rules, you're going to get done. But the fans didn't like it. They booed the Champions League anthem during those games, something they still do, actually. UEFA threatened to fine them for booing the Champions League anthem. So they got signs that said boo on them and held them up, which was quite funny, actually. But, you know, this is a real vitriolic relationship between Man City fans and UEFA. And when it was already bad, the CSKA had their stadium shut. Man City fans had already booked hotels, paid for flights, and UEFA did nothing to help them out. They didn't allow Man City fans in. They banned all fans. And then, to add insult to injury, there are a couple of hundred CSKA fans in colours in the ground anyway when the game came to be played, allegedly behind closed doors. So obviously, this is going to go down badly with City fans, who seem to think there's an agenda against them. There isn't. UEFA, for all their problems, don't go out and out to try and corner certain clubs. Actually, City aren't even one of those clubs they should be trying to corner. But what this does do is it highlights the fatal flaws in financial fair play. It's a very, or at least it seems, to be a very well-meaning initiative. You know, the idea behind it is quite sort of good, isn't it? The idea being that you can only spend what you earn. It should stop mega-rich owners from blowing away the competition. But actually, it's not what it does. Because you can only spend the revenue that you can put on the balance sheet, it means that you can't speculate to accumulate. So what it does is cements the place of the top European clubs at the top of Europe, which some people might say was UEFA's intention in the very first place. That actually what they wanted to do was make sure and help those clubs who were threatening to break away and form their own Super League. They actually wanted to help those clubs stay at the top of European football and make it harder for the likes of City or Atlanta or Eintracht Frankfurt to claw onto them, to lift themselves up onto the same ledge that those top clubs are. And that's what FFP has done. If you have those existing revenue streams, you can spend money. If you don't, it's very hard to do so. And remember that Man City are not a big club. They haven't been around at the top level for a long time. They don't have a big international fan base. They don't have that worldwide revenue that the likes of Arsenal, Manchester United, Chelsea, Liverpool do. They just don't. Now, I know that City are hardly a plucky underdog, an impoverished club. Obviously, they're not. Obviously, they're backed by an entire oil baron. But if all the power and riches of the United Arab Emirates can't lift a team to the top within the regulations, don't you have to start to question the regulations? Are we looking at this and say, actually, the law is an ass because it doesn't allow clubs to progress? It actually makes clubs stay where they are. So if you ask me, UEFA will have to look at this and think, if our rules stop Man City spending their money fairly, are our rules right at all?
Love Sport.
On the line is Andrew Miller. He's the UK editor at ESPN Crick Info. Andrew, no Jofra Archer, no Joss Butler. Is this England starting to work out what their second best combination is because they already know what their best team is?
Yes, pretty much. I think it's extraordinary, really, that you can read so much into four overs. But the fact is that Jofra Archer bowled so well and so quickly with, you know, apparently not even bending his back. He was clocking 90 miles an hour plus. They've decided we've seen plenty here. There's no point in risking him. And also, there's no point in really exposing him. Might as well just keep him up your sleeve because I think it makes an awful lot of sense for England just to, you know, they got nine matches in the group stage of the World Cup, plenty time for him to get up to speed in the competition rather than risk him for it. So yeah, it's really down to the rest of the bowlers to scramble for places. And Chris Wokes, as you mentioned, is scrambling pretty hard this morning. He's looking good.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think, what they call in rowing, I don't know if you're a wet bob, Andrew, but in rowing they call it a seat race.
I was a dry bob, actually.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Then this is not for you, but in rowing they call it a seat race, and that's basically what it is for England's fast bowlers. Who do you think will come out on bottom, if you like? Who's going to suffer because of Jofra Archer?
It's a very good question. I don't know the answer yet, to be honest. I mean, I think it really is going to come down to the final scramble on that final fifth match. I mean, all the bowlers are on trial. I think Joe Denley is an interesting case. He's definitely on trial today because Adil Rashid has been rested, so Denley's getting his chance to play as the leg spinner. I think England do want to go in with three spin options, but it's possible that if he doesn't look up to the part, they may decide that You know, they've got so many good seam options. They'll take a punt because Liam Plunkett has been so good for England for so long. I would be reluctant to go into the World Cup without him. David Willey impressed very much in the game the other day in the Aegeus Bowl. So he's a left arm option. So I like what he's got there. Tom Curran, I love what he does at the death, as I've mentioned before on this show. I think England would like to have him. They've got so many options. I think it really will come down to literally that final flip of the coin on the 23rd of May, having seen as much as they possibly can in these five games.
Of course, the sort of schizophrenic nature of the media coverage of any England team in a World Cup year means that we were in crisis last week, and it sounds like we're going to win the World Cup again. Where do you think the World Cup hosts and favourites are in terms of their preparation? Are they sort of maybe not exactly where they want to be, but pretty close?
They are much closer to where they want to be than I thought they were when the Alex Hales stuff blew up a couple of weeks ago. I thought Owen Morgan was exceptional in ruthless, but exceptional in the way he completely drew a line under that. He threw Hales under a bus, which was harsh, but frankly, he just decided, no, I'm not even going to countenance this. We're gonna knuckle down. We've prepared too long for our distractions off the field to take precedence, and no one's really heard a peep out of Hales since, which is, you know, incredibly tough on him because he's been an important part of England's squad. But no, they've decided they know what they want, and as we saw with Josh Butler's form at the Aegeus Bowl, you know, Hales wasn't even going to be in that first choice 11. Jason Roy's back to form now after his back problems. Johnny Bairstow was tearing up trees at the IPL. England know what their first choice batting 11 is, batting eight really, and it's really down to the bowlers now. So yeah, I think they're in a good place for this World Cup. I've been pretty as confident as an England supporter or England watcher could possibly be about England's hopes in this World Cup, and I'm not wavering from that position. They will be in the final shakedown of this tournament. I'm convinced of that.
That's impressive, given that, you know, I could say three words such as gatting, reverse, sweep, and everything comes falling down. Who do you think? I mean, actually, I know, Andrew, that haven't you got gatting out in a match with a googly?
Goodness me! It was off cutter. That's good knowledge.
Oh, but was yes, it? Okay.
Through the gate. It was glorious.
Oh, there you go.
You've got good spies.
Yeah, I have very good spies, Andrew. Don't worry about that. Just finally, we talked about England being favourites. Who do you think is the perhaps biggest challenger to England's favourites tag, other than themselves, obviously?
No, well, you took words out of my mouth. Themselves is a very, very good challenger. But, you know, you can't look much beyond India simply because they are an immensely powerful white ball team. They've got an immense attack as well. I mean, the one thing I think with India, one thing with England is that they have this incredible strength and depth. And they bat down to number 10, number 11 on occasions, and not many other teams can do that. But where other teams can make up ground on England is with their bowling. I think India's bowling is exceptional. Bumrah is outstanding as a white ball bowler. I think even Australia, who have been through the mill lately, their fast bowlers are not to be sniffed at in English conditions. I think they would certainly put the wind up people. Pakistan, as we saw, they can never be discounted. They put up an immense show at the Aegeus Bowl. And West Indies, they're powerful batsmen. I think the depth that they have in their side when they all start teeing off, no target is safe. So there's huge teams. I haven't even mentioned South Africa and New Zealand, who are always in the reckoning. So I think, frankly, the only team that I would rule out is Sri Lanka, to be honest. I don't see them putting up much of a show. Even Afghanistan are a side that can shake people on their day. I think it's going to be a fascinating World Cup. I think there are going to be a lot of scrambling for places in that final four.
Yeah, let's just hope the weather holds. This is the problem with having an England World Cup, of course. You just get one wet month and everything goes a bit backside overhead. Andrew, thank you very much for coming on and giving us your expert opinion, as always. That's Andrew Miller, UK editor of ESPN Crick Info, and a man who once got Mike Gatting out, which is as good a claim to fame as almost anyone can have, I think, on this show.
Love sports.
It's a playoff semi-final, and there's so much pressure. Yeah, sure, it should be an open game because West Brom are behind and they're at home. But there's so much pressure involved in trying to get back into the Premier League that I really don't see how they can expect it to be an open game, frankly. Let's speak to someone who's been involved with both clubs before. Kenny Swain is on the line, a man who's played for Aston Villa and briefly for West Brom. How difficult is it to have watched Aston Villa struggles? You know, you, of course, were there during one of the great eras. You know, you, of course, played in that 82 European Cup final when Villa were on top of Europe. How difficult has it been to watch the decline at the club and the sink into the second tier?
Well, I mean, for a good few years afterwards, you know, they stabilised and they've had some good years.
Mm.
We're really looking at the last 5 years, I suppose, you're talking about.
Mm.
And, you know, falling adrift into the Championship. You know, for a club of Aston Villa's, you know, size, it's, you know, the size of the club, its history, you know, it just doesn't seem right them being in the Championship. So we've been willing them on for the last 2 or 3 years, but it hasn't come to fruition. But I really do think over these two legs with West Brom, I think they'll do the job. I think they'll go to Wembley. And although Leeds, I've got to give credit to Leeds United, they're the best team I've seen at Villa Park this year, this season. You know, that will be a fantastic. If that's the way it turns out, Leeds United, because they're leading at the moment, and Aston Villa at Wembley, two monster clubs. You know, you're talking top 10. They're both top 10 clubs, in my opinion, in terms of, you know, support, history, etc.
I mean, it's a clash that, you know, 25 years ago, it would have been second versus third in the Premier League, wouldn't it?
Exactly, yes, yeah. Mm. You can't halt, you know, these big clubs with big support, you can't halt their progress. And I'm not predicting they'll be in the final, because who would have predicted Liverpool and Tottenham? But I think we've had the comebacks. I can't see all those comebacks happening again.
It's done now. We're going to get 3-0 over the next three nights. All the exciting... We've done up with exciting football. I don't think my heart could cope, frankly. If it does come down to Aston Villa and Leeds in the final, who would you be backing? Obviously, you'd want Villa to win, but do you think they've got enough to get past Marcelo Bielsa's Leeds?
Yes, I do. Even last year, I went to the playoff against Fulham, and I fancied Villa strongly, even though they weren't on the rise. And yet on the day, I mean, Fulham completely outplayed them. And, you know, the best team won on the day and the best team went up, you know, because I was quite impressed with Fulham last year. But this year, I don't want to tempt Providence at all, but I've got a much stronger feeling that Villa are in the ascendancy.
Mm.
Leeds have hit a little bit of a dip at the end of the season. And, you know, those sorts of things matter when it comes to the final playoffs.
Yeah, exactly. It seems that form is so much more important in those horribly tight games. Kenny, I have to just ask you while you're here about Chelsea, of course, because you spent a good 5 years at that club as well. We're hearing, and look, it's pretty concerning for Chelsea fans all round to hear Eden Hazard talk pretty non-committally about his future. Do you think he will be at the club next year?
In all honesty, and I've no grounds for saying it other than, you know, football instinct, no, I think, you know, if all the talk about Real Madrid is true, then understanding and, you know, going to places like Real Madrid and understanding, you know, what they stand for, it's a very, very difficult opportunity to turn down that. Mm. And I can't think of any English footballer who's turned down that. Well, not English football, but a footballer leaving, you know, an English club, turning down that opportunity, if that exists.
Mm, yeah. And how big a blow do you think that'd be to the club? Because I've looked at Chelsea sometimes this year. You know, we do our own little awards at Love Sport, and I've put Eden Hazard on the shortlist for most valuable player, because I look at Chelsea and think, I don't know how they could live without him. How? I mean, I know they've probably got a transfer ban this summer as well, so who do you think is going to step up and replace him?
Wow. Well, they've got a habit of buying good players and good players turning into great players.
Mm.
If it does turn out that way, I think they're going to be losing, in my opinion, the best player in the country. Mm. And yet we've had some fantastic performances this year from, you know, Eriksen at Tottenham. I think he's world-class. Salah, he's world-class. And I think, you know, Manchester City have got one or two. You know, De Bruyne.
They got about 15. That's the problem, Kenny.
Yeah. No, they've got two or three world class players there at Manchester City, and I think, you know, Eden Hazard for me tops them all. Yeah. He's got a bit of everything. Even if he's not scoring goals, he's making goals. If he's not making goals, he's causing defences absolute havoc. I think he's a wonderful player.
Yeah. I just wonder whether, sorry to just finally butt in on you, Callum Hudson-Odoi is a guy who I think you've probably seen a little bit of coming through and gotten a good feel for. Do you think he is, and I know, look, I would never want to say he's the next Eden Hazard, but do you think he's the type of player and character who can begin to fill those boots next year if he's given the chance?
I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure he'll be in that class. I think he's got enormous potential still. And, you know, the fact that they're talking about transfers for him at this particular stage, I think it needs a bucket of water thrown all over that.
Yeah.
Because he needs time to develop, and he needs time also to sort his mind out and for the club to sort out the minds of whoever's, you know, encouraging him to go somewhere. You know, I think he needs a period of real, you know, settling down into Chelsea's team, being a regular player, and then seeing, you know, what sort of contribution can he make then.
Yeah, Kenny, very wise words. Thank you so much for coming on and persisting through some dodgy signal. Always a pleasure to have someone like you. Kenny Swain there, a man who won the European Cup with Aston Villa all the way back in 1982, and he's backing them to get back into the top flight of English football, but they've got to get past West Brom tonight first.
Love Sport.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer cancelled, we understand, according to a story in the Mail, cancelled Manchester United's Monday morning meeting, which they should have had yesterday, obviously, it being Monday. Now, if you work in a normal office or any sort of business, a radio station perhaps, you know, Monday morning meetings, pretty regular thing, the kind of thing you just sit down, get the lay of the land, work out where everyone's going, what everyone's doing each week. Probably not that unusual either for the boss just to go, can we just not do it this week, or we'll do it tomorrow, we'll do it this afternoon, we've got a few things on. All fairly regular stuff. But to cancel it altogether is quite punchy, because actually you need that time. But it's especially punchy when this wasn't just a Monday morning meeting. This was the last day in training before all the players go off on holiday. And Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, we understand, was due to have one-on-one meetings with players, a sort of annual review. Again, the kind of thing that any normal company does on a regular basis. And it's all very well saying, oh, but, you know, football clubs aren't normal companies. But actually, they probably should be, because it's hugely inefficient to run any sort of business inefficiently. And it's a truism, but it is true. That's why it is. And so I can't understand why United are insisting on trying to mess this up again. Half the reason they're in the mess they're in is because they haven't dealt with their problems properly. They haven't accepted that they might have problems. The end of the Alex Ferguson era, they were in decline and they didn't recognise it. They didn't have a plan, and they still seem not to have a plan. So when I hear then that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has cancelled these meetings, he says he wants to spend more time today, or at least, according to the Mail again, wants to spend more time today with the club staff. Now, that makes some sense to me, but surely these meetings with players are really important, because they're going to go off on holiday. And you don't want to have those important conversations with them while they're sitting on the beach in Dubai with the Trotters up in Nice, perhaps, with David Cameron. You know, it doesn't make any sense. So I'm really surprised, and I don't think it's a great piece of management. We understand the dressing room on Sunday at Old Trafford was a particularly nasty place to be. Mark Dempsey, one of Solskjaer's lieutenants, who is going to stay on next year, we understand. He was going around telling players not to answer back and tearing lumps out of them after they lost to Cardiff. So I would think, as a boss, you don't want that to be your last message to the players before they go away for the summer. Sure, they've had a bad season, and I think they could do with a little bit of a kick up the backside. They've always seemed to need that, this Manchester United group. However, I do think that it also needs a bit of analysis and a bit of sitting down with players and saying, look, how do you think we can get better next season? How do you think you can get better next season? Here are some things to think about over the summer. Very strange to let them go on such a bad note. Remember that Solskjaer now faces probably the biggest... No, in fact, it is the biggest challenge of his professional career, playing or managerial, because he's charged with rebuilding a club with uber-high expectations that finished 32 points behind its biggest City rivals in Manchester City and 32 points off Premier League title winners. That's a long way. That's a whole team, a whole relegated team that United couldn't beat, worth of points. It's disgraceful that they find themselves that far away when you consider how lengthy their success was. And it reminds me of Liverpool at the end of the 1980s, when they say in the club, there was no recognition that things wouldn't always be like this. There was just an assumption that things would always be with Liverpool at the top, Liverpool dominating. That was what people assumed would happen. Well, you know, we've been the best side for so long, it'll just keep happening, and you can't. The reason Pep Guardiola's successful is he just keeps on going. He's always trying to improve. It's relentless. He said before they even won the title, we're going to be better next year. That's the kind of thing that breeds success. On the positive side for United, I would say that this Solskjaer decision at least means he's starting to show some edge. Because while he came in and his, you know, softly, softly catchy monkey style of management was a pleasant breeze to the, you know, the heat of Jose Mourinho's caustic regime, it's now wearing off. And the players, I don't think, have a lot of respect for him. Sure, they like him, but you can't be their mate as a manager. Maybe the physio, maybe the kit man, they can be mates of the players. But as a manager, you need to create some distance. I take an example of Neil Harris. I've spoken to a number of players who played with Neil Harris and have also played under him at Millwall. And every single one of them has said that it's different. Oh, I went to the club and it was different with Neil all of a sudden. Because he had to distance himself from the players. He had to say, sorry, I'm a manager now. It needs to be different. And that's what I think Solskjaer needs to learn. He may learn it, and this, albeit a slightly bizarre managerial decision to just cancel these meetings on a whim, at least suggests to me that there is some bite in him. And that he had said, you know what, lads, actually, you need to realise that I'm not a soft touch. And I hope that that suggests he's understanding it going forward, because these players need it. Because what are these players interested in? One of the reasons that the club has been so successful is the devotion to the team. The understanding that this isn't about me, this is about the team. And sports psychologists always talk about this. They talk about finding a community to play for, because playing for yourself actually isn't enough. It's not enough of a motivation for most people. So you need to find a community to represent. With United, it should be obvious. You've got those fans that turn up at Old Trafford every fortnight. You know, there's famous stories of Fergie taking potential signings out to Old Trafford, empty, standing in the centre circle and saying, how do you fancy playing here every 2 weeks? I think that was Dion Dublin he said that to. And it was just a no-brainer. So they shouldn't have to work hard to find a community to play for. I guess, as a modern footballer, it's easy to get lulled into the sense of you're important as a person. Because of your social media following, your personal brand and all of that, it's easy to forget that what puts you on that pedestal and what makes you successful is the team, the shirt that you're wearing, the badge on that shirt. If you're playing in a bad team, you just won't be as successful. Wilfried Zaha's a great player, but he's playing for Crystal Palace, so he's never going to be a star on the same level as James Milner. I know that sounds counterintuitive, and actually, frankly, James Milner's underrated. But nevertheless, take Divock Origi, who's probably a worse player in a similar position to Wilfried Zaha, but he's a bigger star because he's probably going to win a Champions League this year, or at least he might. I can hear angry Tottenham fans already. Wilfried Zaha's not going to win a Champions League this year. Wilfried Zaha's never played in a Champions League final. Wilfried Zaha's barely played in the Champions League full stop, I think. And yet, it's because he's not part of the team. And players have to understand that teams exist for a reason. And one of those reasons is that people believe in them. And even as players who are brilliant individuals and understand that they play as individuals to a certain extent, even those players need to play for the team.
Love Sport.
It's not about the best player. It's not about the top goal scorer or the person who gets the most fantasy points. It's about this player who is, on their own, the most important to their club and has been the most important to their club. One of the nominees is Wilfried Zaha because he, of course, I mean, he is Crystal Palace, isn't he? He makes everything tick. We've got on the line to talk a little bit about him, former Crystal Palace striker Neil Shipperley. Neil, first of all, I wonder if you could sum up Wilfried Zaha's season at Crystal Palace. How impressed have you been with him this year compared to what is an enormous body of work at Palace, let's face it?
Yeah, I think he does it season in, season out, really. He was his important started working down there sort of two or three seasons ago. Has he improved? I don't really know if he improved, but he's just a really important player for Palace. I mean, and he's human as well. I mean, he can't play well every single week, but I mean, he has magnificent games more than he has average games, that's for sure.
Mm. When you look around the team, obviously top scorer this season, Luka Milivojević, thanks to his unbelievable form from the penalty spot, let's be frank. But Wilf is the main goal threat. Do you think that he shoulders too much a responsibility there? Because obviously there is a lot of pressure on him to perform for Palace, not only because of who he is, but because of who he is in terms of the club. You know, he's been in that club for so long.
Yeah, he's a very important player. I mean, when we have to play him up front, and we've had a really indifferent season. We've played a lot of the season without a recognised centre-forward. So, you know, we put him up front, and he still managed to, you know, make a goal and obviously play well. But, I mean, his position is playing off someone or playing on the wing. And you know, like we saw the weekend, you know, they wind him up and he went down the left-hand side. And, I mean, some of the challenges trying to knock him off the ball was, you know, wouldn't have broken him. But he still stays up. He's so strong. So he's a better player for us on the wing. But, like you said, he's been our main threat, bar Luke. With his penalties on nicking a goal.
Mm. How impressed, you mentioned those challenges, and you're right, there were some pretty agricultural attempts to bring him down in that game. Do you think he's got better at dealing with that? Because he's always been a bit of a target, and in previous years, it might have affected him. Do you think he has grown up a little bit in terms of reacting to that sort of stuff?
Maybe a bit, but I think that's one part of the game where, at the moment, he, you know, because he plays for Palace, he let himself down against Southampton, you know, responding to stuff. So he isn't completely out of that. Who's got better is up for debate. But that's the one thing which is going to stop him from, you know, getting into your kind of like your Hazard mould and stuff like that. Because he is a target and he has to deal with it better. But it's easily said than done. If you've got someone trying to kick you or, you know, the whole team trying to get you, it's easily said than done, you know.
Yeah. How, I mean, in your playing career, I'm sure you played up front, scored plenty of goals. I'm sure you got your fair share of kicking. What did you tend to do to deal with it?
Well, I weren't as quick as Zaha, and he weren't as heavy as me, so it was a little bit different. I could probably handle myself a little bit better, but no, completely different. I mean, me and him in the same breath don't work, so let's not go there.
But all right.
I know what you're saying. No, it's completely different. As a target man, you get into battles, and that is part of your game where, you know, they weren't trying to stop me. That was just a physical side of it. But with Zaha, I mean, they're out. It's people have even said now, isn't it? I think Troy Deeney said that they were taking in turns and kicking him. So they know that if they stop Zaha, they stop, you know, a massive percentage of Palace.
I know that you spent a little bit of time at Chelsea as well, Neil. And as I mentioned, on this most valuable player list, we've got Zaha and Hazard. I wonder which player do you think is more important to their team, Zaha to Palace or Hazard to Chelsea? Because I look at Chelsea sometimes and think, without Hazard, I don't know if they've got much of a threat.
Well, yeah, I mean, Palace and Chelsea as clubs, you know, Chelsea are obviously a lot bigger club, and to have a player with importance as Hazard, you know, it's quite remarkable because they are a massive club. So that's always not going to be the case. But with someone like Palace, you know, with a Zaha, I think he's easily more worth to the club what he probably is in the market. And because he's quite weird, you know, I mean, we do need him, and he's won games single-handedly.
Yeah,
and we do rely on him, and so I would say we are. And throughout the years to come, you won't really have a player who's going to just, you know, lead Chelsea the way that Hazard is, because they're a bigger club.
Yeah. Just finally, Neil, to come back to Palace, obviously a sort of a middling season, I suppose. There was a brief period of time when they thought there might be in a relegation battle, but it didn't turn out that way. What are your hopes for Palace next season? How do you think they can move forward now?
Well, if they don't invest, and we can keep the same amount of players, then anything the same is going to...
There we go. Sorry,
compared to other clubs.
Yeah, carry on, Neil. Sorry. No, we lost you. We got you back now.
Oh, yeah, no, I was just saying, you know, to finish the same position we were, without no investment, would be remarkable. People forget we only spent 10 million on Chiarty, or 8 million. And I know we had to pay 3 million for Batshuayi at the end, but we didn't spend a lot of money compared to the rest of us, and we're going to keep getting away with it. So I think Roy and Ray and the team deserve an awful amount of credit to be safe with four games to go. I think it's remarkable.
Yeah, quite. Neil, thanks very much for coming on and giving us your insight. Always interesting to hear from someone who's been there, done that, former Crystal Palace striker and Chelsea striker for that matter, Neil Shipperley. Who is more important to their club? Is it Eden Hazard? Is it Wilfred Zaha? We've also mentioned Lucas Fabianski. He's had a massive year in goal for West Ham. And Glenn Murray, 13 goals for Brighton, without which I'm sure they wouldn't have stayed up.
Love Sport.
Talking about Chris Hughton and his sacking and his replacement. Now, we still don't have a replacement at Brighton. Hughton was sacked on Monday. It's been a pretty grim 48 hours for him, I think you'll agree. He went from thinking he might be about to make himself an absolute hero in Liverpool when Glenn Murray scored for Brighton against Manchester City. I'm sure the former Spurs and West Ham fullback probably didn't think he'd ever be much of a hero in Liverpool, but he would have been had they been able to hold on to that 1-0 win. It went from that to the disappointment of having lost 4-1 while being ahead, to the relief of walking around the pitch at the Amex thinking, you know what, summer holidays are coming, I'm with my grandkids, yeah, this is good fun. Knowing he'd kept Brighton in the Premier League for the second season in a row, probably looking forward to just, you know, a couple of days off and then starting to plan again because the football season never really stops. But then all of a sudden to being tossed out on his backside on Monday morning. Now, sure, Brighton have been poor in the second half of the season. No one can deny that. 2 wins in 23, not that impressive. There's been poor home results too. A 5-0 defeat to Bournemouth, that was a particularly grey day. And that was in the middle of a run of 7 games without a goal. Okay, I don't deny that. That's bad. At times, I've criticised Hughton for failing to show ambition against the bigger sides, and it does frustrate me when you see them come out. And a lot of sides down the bottom half of the table do this, and show no desire to have the ball even when they're playing against Man City, Liverpool, Chelsea, Tottenham. And I often think, actually, your best chance of getting anything out of this game is to go at them. But Brighton have shown just about enough in this season. You know, a good first half of the season, although I think most people, including myself, thought that that would fade. But they also showed a bit of fight back. I know they didn't pick up wins, but there are some results in there that are really impressive. That 0-0 draw with Wolves was absolutely crucial. They nearly got a point against Tottenham at the new stadium, which for former Spurs man Hughton would have been massive, by the way. And they were not far away, you know, against a Spurs sider in the Champions League final, who were playing in their brand new stadium. So don't think that wouldn't have been a great result. And getting close is still creditable. I know football is a results business, and it is a harsh business, but if you're the Brighton chairman, if you're Tony Bloom, surely you have to, or Dan Ashworth, for example, the technical director, the man who calls himself the conduit between the board of directors and the football department, surely you have to look at those last few games. That 1-1 draw with Arsenal, where Brighton played with a bit of freedom, and they really got after Arsenal. They were brilliant. Surely you look at those performances and think, yeah, actually, maybe there is a bit to this team. And surely you look at the signings that have been made, and you can only assume that a lot of that decision-making was made above Chris Hughton's head. Surely you look at all those things and think, maybe Hughton's got a bit here. And he knows the club so well, he's popular with the players, he's got that bit of bite that he sometimes needs. Maybe we just need to invest in the right way. And now that we've got technical director Dan Ashworth in, a bloke who knows how to run these things, that'll be a little bit easier. So I'm surprised then when on Monday morning he throws him out. Now, they almost sacked him 4 weeks previously, according to the Argus this morning. The 5-0 home defeat to Bournemouth nearly saw him out in the cold, which would have been quite reactionary, but also slightly understandable, because that's what happens in football very often these days. But I still don't think it's right. And he had no idea, apparently, after the game on Sunday he was going to get sacked. He just didn't think that he would be. He kept them up, he took them up, remember, and he kept them up again. Twice in the toughest league of all. That deserves some credit in the bank. Getting Brighton into the Premier League and keeping them in the Premier League. And he's been sacked harshly so many times. Newcastle, Norwich, and now Brighton. I've got to wonder whether chairman look at Chris Hughton and think he's just too nice. Too nice to be successful. Because to be successful in business, you do have to be cutthroat. And there is something about these most successful businessmen where decisions are made very quickly because they know that hesitating on a decision slows you down. And it can be costly. But I can't help but think, looking at Chris Hughton, and I go, well, what, you're going to bring in Graham Potter? Is that really progress? Sure, amazing job with Ostersund, really impressive. He's done all right with Swansea, but he's not torn up any trees in South Wales. And I just wonder whether that's really progress. Whether you take someone and think, well, yeah, are we going to get better than Chris Hughton? Adam Virgo said something interesting yesterday, that he thought if Brighton had been relegated, Hughton would have had a better chance of keeping his job. I think he's right, because being in the Championship, you need someone who knows that league. Chris Hughton knows the club, knows the league. Yeah, I think you keep him. But for some reason, Brighton think they can get someone better. I will be fascinated to see who they do get in, because I don't think it'll be Graham Potter, although he may be 7-1 on with the bookies, because there are no other names being thrown around, and they must cast their net wider than that. I'll be fascinated to see who it is. I don't know how much better than Chris Hughton they can do.
Love Sport.
I want to talk a little bit about the cricket, because some interesting decisions have been taken by England today. No Jofra Archer in the side, which is a little bit of a surprise, but I think it does give you a bit of an inkling about what they're thinking. Both Chris Jordan and Liam Plunkett will be thinking, wow, England haven't picked Jofra Archer today. England haven't picked the man who has only bowled about 96 deliveries in international cricket. 72 in ODIs, 24 in T20s. And yet they've not picked him in what is one of their last warm-up games for the World Cup. What that tells us is that Jofra Archer is almost certainly going to be included in England's World Cup squad this summer. 23rd of May, 9 days until they have to confirm that squad. Of course, Archer wasn't included in the preliminary squad, but then was picked for this series. And what that tells you is England felt they couldn't actually pick a debutant. But now, it means that they're more than likely going to drop a fast bowler. Because Alex Hales, of course, has missed out due to his ban and his dropping from the side. So they've brought in James Vince. But who is going to miss out because of Jofra Archer? The likelihood is they'll drop one of, say, Tom Curran, Liam Plunkett, David Willey, Chris Wokes or Mark Wood. Now, I think you can rule Mark Wood out of that. Because when he's bowling at his quickest, I think they like having him as part of the attack. David Willey is impressed with the ball. Chris Wokes has been brilliant today, shown a bit more pace. He moves the ball off the seam. He can get things out of wickets when other bowlers can't. And I think that leaves Tom Curran. It feels extraordinarily harsh on him for a guy who's just making his way in international cricket but has done almost nothing wrong. And he also has something England really lack, which is quality at the death. Now, I've always said England need good fast bowlers at the death. And I've always thought that they struggle in that area. Chris Jordan, for a while, was their go-to death bowler. Now not in the world preliminary World Cup squad. Could, of course, if he plays absolutely brilliantly, you know, force his way back in. But it seems unlikely. So I'm kind of wondering now whether Jofra Archer is into the side and whether Tom Curran is going to be the man who misses out. I mean, Tom Curran's played 14 ODIs. His bowling average is under 30. He goes at about a run a ball, which in modern one-day cricket is pretty good, especially for a bloke who bowls at the death a lot. And I just think he must feel so unfortunate. He averages 40 with the bat, right? There's a lot of not outs there. But, you know, he's no slouch with the bat either. So England are going to have to make some difficult decisions. But the positive thing is that these difficult decisions are not who on earth are we going to pick. It's who on earth are we going to drop. And frankly, that's something we've not been in a position to do for a long time. If you think about other World Cups, let's say last time out, down in Australia and New Zealand, we were in all sorts of trouble. We didn't know who we were playing where, but now, at least our batting lineup is pretty solid. I think we know who England's best top eight is. They've changed things around a little bit today. Owen Morgan will go and bat at 6. Stokes is going to bat at 4. Moeen Ali in at 5. And Joe Denley at 7. So that's a bit different, and they're trying to work out. I think they're trying to work out, and I said it to Andrew Miller earlier, I think they're trying to work out what their best second 11 is. Because at the moment, I think they know what their best first 11 is, give or take one or two players and one or two stylistic choices. But the World Cup is long. It starts on the 30th of May for England. They take on South Africa at the Oval. And it finishes, if they get to the final, in the second week of July. That is a long time. Players will get injured. Players will need resting. Joss Butler can't score 100 in every game. They're going to need support. And I think what they're trying to do at the moment is work through all the different combinations and try and get their head round what they can do with those different players. They've got a lot of depth in this squad. And the advantage of having a group of players, almost all of whom can bat, you know, I would back almost any of those guys to score an ODI 50 or 60 under pressure. Liam Plunkett, maybe the only one who you wouldn't back in that situation. Pretty much everyone else has enough about them to prove that they can do something with the bat in ODIs. I don't know what their best team's going to be. I certainly don't know what their best squad is going to be. But I think they're in a brilliant position. As I said earlier, maybe the only people who can stop England from winning the World Cup now are England.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to the James Gray Show podcast edition. Please do leave us a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, you can listen to the show live on Love Sport Radio every weekday from 1 p.m. until 3:30.